Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
There's a lot of really cool stuff in here that most people have never heard of and never will hear of again. One of my favorites that we've got in the store is a Filipino Batman movie called James Batman.
Mga ulol, kayo pa lalaban sa aming mga sindikato.
It's really, really good. This DVD doesn't have any English on it, so it's hard to understand, but I've seen it 3 times. It's really terrific.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and Matt Lynch is showing me around Scarecrow Video in Seattle. They have more than 130,000 DVDs, Blu-rays, Laserdiscs, and yes, VHS tapes.
European horror, Italian horror, Japanese horror, Chinese horror, Thai horror, Korean horror, Mexican horror, Turkish horror, Indonesian and Malaysian horror.
How's Dr. Satan?
Dr. Satan's really good, actually. I really like...
Scarecrow is one of just 3 video rental stores still kicking in Seattle. They've been around for about 30 years, but as you probably know, in the last decade or so, online streaming has wiped out a huge chunk of the industry.
And so that's when you begin to see the death of our neighborhood video store as we knew it, you know, where there would be one in every neighborhood around, you know, every other block had a video store. And we could all survive.
Kate Barr is executive director here. She says the reality was not lost on the previous owners.
They had been noticing that decline over like a 4 or 5 year period before they finally, you know, said, okay, this enough is enough. We're not willing to kind of pay out of pocket to keep this going. And, you know, we faced a crossroads where either you make the choice to downscale. We could have sold off 3/4 of the collection and just become very lean and mean. But the problem is this collection is so large that it now has cultural significance.
I mean, James Batman, right? Really, though, this collection is a valuable archive. Kate says they have dozens of films that even the Library of Congress doesn't have. So breaking it up was out of the question.
So they did a call for proposals, but they would only consider nonprofits. And their criteria was the collection needs to stay together, needs to remain open to the public, and ideally would remain in Seattle.
Let's put that collection in context. Take all the movies and specials and TV shows that stream on Netflix, and Scarecrow dwarfs it by like a factor of 20.
The truth is they have very, very little available, very little content available. What they have done is sold the idea that they have everything. And that is what they have done very, very well.
So how do you compete with that?
Yes, that's a question we ask ourselves every day, is how does one compete against the sale of an idea? And we're still trying to figure that out.
For the newly nonprofit Scarecrow, a big part of the answer to that has been to hug the community even closer.
We now have many more community programs than we did. We had free outdoor movies in Magnuson Park this past summer. We have silver screeners where we go out in the community and show movies at community and senior centers. We have a children's hour in partnership with the Seattle Public Library. The screening room that we're currently sitting in right now, we have free screenings in here 15 to 17 days out of every month.
In short, Scarecrow has embraced its role as a cultural resource. Competition can bring out the best in people, and the worst, too. That's our theme today on Sound Effect from KNKX, stories of the thrill and the agony of competition. Now it's time to introduce you to some winners. The Port Townsend Drizzle is a women's over 50 basketball team with 3 gold medals in the Washington State Senior Games. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing spent some time on and off the court with these champions and tells us how sometimes losing can be sweeter than victory.
11 women run up and down the wooden court in the YMCA's gymnasium in Port Townsend. This is where the team meets twice a week. One of the players is Beverly Hetrick. She's 69 years young. She wipes the sweat from her forehead, pushing aside her gray bangs.
Some of us played in school and high school and college back in the day before Title IX, and in those days, you could only run half court. You could have three steps or three dribbles, and then you had to pass it. And so one of my pleasures in coming is to have lived long enough that things have changed and moved forward, that we can play 5-on-5, full court, flat out, and have fun too.
And what was the rationale for the three steps and then passing?
It was thought that at the time it was too stressful on women, that they couldn't handle it.
The idea for starting the Port Townsend Drizzle happened several years ago when Joanna Sanders went to watch her daughter play basketball for her high school team.
And I sat in the stands crocheting potholders to keep my hands busy, nervously watching, thinking, oh my gosh, she's playing this. It's such an intense sport, and watching them run up and down the court, and I'm hoping that she doesn't get a concussion or get hurt, and I'm knitting these tight potholders.
Joanna really needed some company in the stands to lighten things up, so she asked her friend Robin Steeman to come and watch the high school girls team play. Robin went, and being a complete newbie, she had a lot of questions for her friend Joanna.
And she talked to me through the whole thing. I'm like, quiet, quiet, I'm trying to watch the game here. Like, I don't know what's going on. But, you know, she's learning how to even be a spectator and watching. And soon after watching a basketball game, I said, you know, I'm just not having any fun in life. I have got to find some fun. And she threw out, well, why don't we play basketball sometime? Do you like to play basketball? And I go, really? You'd play basketball? She's like, sure. Let's get some women together. You call a few friends. I'll call a few friends. I go, really? Yeah, pick a date. We each bring a few friends, see how it goes.
Robin was the energy that got the Drizzle together, even though, again, she knew nothing about basketball.
Well, I'll tell you a funny thing is that after watching for a whole year, I went the following year, and I said to David, my husband, there's these little clocks up at the end. They put those up this year. And he said, no, those have always been there. And I said, no, they were never there. And he said, I said, what are they for? He said, they're shot clocks. They've always been there. And I said, no, I don't think they were there last year.
For those of you who don't know, the shot clock tells the team that has the ball, has possession, how much time they have left to make a shot.
It took me a while to, you know, get the finer points.
The women of the Drizzle would hang out on an outdoor court in town behind Port Townsend's old historic courthouse. They'd dribble, talk, catch up. They were pretty freeform without a coach. Enter Christy Wilson. She was new in town. She loved playing basketball in college, but when life got busy, she stopped.
You know, you become a mom and you have to go to work and you just, you know, you don't do that. And women, for the most part, don't seem to continue to play basketball. It seems like it's a man sport.
A friend told her about Joanna, Robin, and their motley crew who were meeting up to shoot hoops.
And I thought, oh, that could be fun. And so I snuck down one of the streets so that I could watch them before I jumped in, because I didn't want to be like really bad. And I'm watching them from a distance. They didn't know I was there. And it happened to be one of the days where they were Lippenzahner, they were doing the Lippenzahner move.
What Christy saw was a bunch of grown women skipping like schoolgirls as high as possible up into the air, the Lippenzahner, looking absolutely ridiculous and having a lot of fun. And they had no idea they were being watched.
And I thought, oh my gosh. These guys don't know how to play basketball. I can't be a part of this. I have to compete. There's no way I can do this. And they were goofing around and joking around, and I thought, I can't do it. I turned around and I walked away.
A few months later, Christy decided to give it another try.
These women knew how to play basketball. They were just goofing around. And not only do they know how to play basketball, they had a passion for the game that I used to have way back in the day that I'd lost somewhere along the way just because life happens. It was like a renewal for me.
Under Christy's guidance, the team got better. They did drills, they practiced plays, they studied how to referee games. Soon, they were ready to turn things up a notch. And in 2015, they headed to the senior games in Olympia. They won the gold.
So then the second year, we're like, yeah, we're the reigning champions. We're going to go down and we're going to do it again. But, you know, we're going to get gold because we're the only ones.
The Drizzle got gold for 3 years in a row because they were the only women's team playing. They had to play against themselves. This was getting kind of old. They wanted real competition. They wanted a win to mean something. So Robin Steeman, the heart of the team, wrote a video, a sort of personal ad, and put it up on YouTube.
For Lauren Senior Women's Basketball Team, the Port Townsend Drizzle seeks more teams to end our lonely days at the Washington State Senior Games in Olympia. Come on, women of Washington State. We know you're out there. Come and show us what you've got. Take us to school. Boom!
We double dog dare you!
The call was answered. When the senior games rolled around again, the Port Townsend Drizzle actually had a half dozen other women's teams to play against. Christy, the coach, was a little bit worried about who the Drizzle was now up against.
They were tall, and they were big, and they were physical, and they were talented. And I'm going, oh dear. We played our game. We didn't play theirs. Some of them were very dirty, and we came out with our heads high. We played 5 games. We were exhausted.
Robin says that on that day, the reign of the Port Townsend Drizzle finally came to an end.
Really, we were last. One of the things that this basketball journey has given me is just who cares? My self-esteem isn't tied up in if we got the gold or we got the bronze. What I care about is that we play twice a week, we have fun, we work hard, we have these relationships, and we have the joy of the game and the play, and that's what matters.
Back at the gym, the women will not let me leave until I play a quick game. This is the first time I've ever played basketball outside of noodling around solo on a court trying to get the ball in the hoop. And I'm wearing Mary Jane's, not the best shoes. We break up into a blue team and a white team.
Let's have a 1 minute meeting where we...
Okay, white. Oh. Blue. Oh, white. 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 We don't
have enough white. And then we do a quick huddle.
What's your plan?
So, zone defense.
And the Drizzle, we have a rule, we don't dunk.
No hanging off the rim.
No hanging on the rim. Yeah. No goaltending.
And no injuries. The Drizzle is welcoming to anyone who wants to play, including women who are really good at other things, like playing violin or dance, but who are total basketball virgins. For Christy, one of the players with the most experience with this game, seeing these other women try something so new and different in their later years is what pushed her last year to sign up for her first downhill ski lesson. And she tells me this as she rubs her shoulder that was dislocated on the slopes last winter. She says she'd rather be out trying and failing than sticking with what makes her feel comfortable.
Good game.
Good job.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wynn. This is Sound Effect. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories of competition. For this next story, we drop in on an ordinary ball game in an extraordinary place. Seattle NABA is the local branch of the National Adult Baseball Association. When they're not suited up, they're tech workers and bartenders and consultants, at least one retiree. The San Quentin A's, in their green and gold uniforms, are all inmates at San Quentin Prison in California. Recently, the Seattle team got the opportunity to head south and play a series against the A's inside the prison. Along for the ride was Steve Albertson, the director of administration here at KNKX. Two of his brothers play on the Seattle team, and Steve was there to document it.
So the baseball program has been going, I think I was told, for 100 years. So it's been around for a long time. They used to have prison baseball leagues. They would play against army bases nearby. So my understanding is San Quentin is just a very unique prison, and they have a lot of athletic programs. They have baseball, basketball, soccer, flag football, tennis, and there may be some other ones, but they bring in outside teams to play. It's just part of the program for the prisoners. I just assumed it would be very restricted. You know, there'd be a lot of guards around. There wouldn't be a lot of prisoner outsider interaction. I thought it would be kind of like show up, play baseball, don't talk a lot to the other team, and then leave. And that's really what I was kind of expecting. So you go through a little security. They send you in through one iron gate. And then once you're all in that iron gate, they open the other iron gate, and suddenly you're in the prison. There's palm trees, nice gardening. There's the hospital right there when you come in. But then you go down this ramp, and this long ramp, and you take a left, and suddenly you're in the yard. And it's just this gigantic open space in the middle of the prison. And the thing that struck me immediately is there were no guards. There were hundreds of inmates walking around doing stuff, and there were no guards. It's a beautiful day for baseball. Teams are warming up. They're playing a dual scrimmage.
My name is Liddell Steffi. I'm from Spanaway, Washington. It looks pretty much like a community college or college setting. You have inmates that are walking around with books and class stuff. They have to get to class and stuff like that. And it's up to us to help them get back into society in the future. And that's why I came down.
Inmates just started coming up and talking to us. So it was from the get-go a different experience than I expected.
Tamon Halfin.
How long have you been playing baseball with the A's?
I grew up playing baseball, so I've been playing my whole life, but got incarcerated and, you know, everything just fell off.
What's it like being on this team?
I love it. It literally takes you away from this environment. It's a beautiful thing. I had no idea that this was a thing until I got here. I never heard of it.
Just very strangely welcoming and very gracious and thankful that we were there to a person. I was really astounded how open and friendly people were. It's not what you'd expect of a pretty serious prison with people who have committed pretty serious crimes.
My name is Michael R. Polito.
I had started walking up to people and talking to them, and Michael was wearing, he was part of the San Quentin team. He was wearing a San Quentin jersey.
Well, the story starts, I got arrested at 15 years old. Never really played sports out there on the streets. I was given life without parole.
His position as an equipment manager is very important. Equipment's hard to come by. They track it very carefully because obviously a baseball bat and various other things could be used as weapons in the prison.
Just I felt like I could help him out by doing the equipment, and it's fulfilling for me because I never really had a chance to do it since being locked up so young, you know?
Yeah, it just reminded me, like, I have a 15-year-old son, and, you know, for someone to do something, a crime that would just stop their life at that point, and 28 years later, he's still in jail for it. 15-year-olds make mistakes, and they do, especially in this case, may have done something really terrible, but it's just hard to see somebody whose whole life has just been thrown away like that.
Like, the first time I came to this prison, and I seen these guys in these uniforms, I thought they were people from the streets. So I treated them differently, but when they took off their uniforms and put on the blues, I was like, wow. Now that I'm suited up, I actually make the effort every game to come out here and talk to all these guys, because I used to be out there up along the fence wondering what these guys were doing.
Putting on that uniform, it's like no other. Like, you're not in blue no more. My name is Brandon Terrell. I remember this specific time last year we were playing the Stompers, which is a professional team. It was a Saturday afternoon. I'm like, there's no other place I'd rather be than right here in this moment. Like, I'm gonna get out to my family one day. I'm gonna be, you know, free. However, like, in that moment, like, that experience, what I was feeling that I never had before, and it just was like, I wasn't in prison. On February 23rd, 2012, I was with a friend of mine. We went out, we had a few drinks. I had actually relapsed. I had been sober for 7 months prior to that. For whatever reason, at the dinner table when we were ordering our food and drinks, I decided to order a couple cocktails. And within hours, I was being arrested for murder of my own friend, Ryan Roth. And what happened was an altercation happened and I ultimately stabbed him. I received 11 years for voluntary manslaughter. And within a week of sitting in that jail cell after, you know, I cleared my mind and realized, you know, that I got a long journey ahead of me and I made a huge mistake and that I can't go back. But I realized there's a purpose out of this, and it's for me to help people down the road get sober, live a sober life, and use my own experience as an example. When these outside teams come in and walk down that hill, you know, the gate shuts behind them. They see the signs, no warning shots. They see the signs, no hostage. I know they had to have some type of feeling, some type of anxiety. Probably they weren't fully comfortable, right? And by the time that first pitch is thrown and we're in that ball game, I want them to understand and get that feeling like they're not in prison, right? Like that we're just men. So here we are. That's something we got to do every game, every practice, run these geese off the field. The fact that these people come in here, spend the money, take time away from their family, I couldn't say enough to thank them. That's why I go out there and work on the field as much as I do and to the program in general, because I want the inmates and here in the prison to be able to enjoy this facility and the field. However, I feel I owe it to these people that are traveling from distances away to make our field as nice as we can, you know, and have the best experience.
Yeah, what's up, Mark? I got the lineup right here. Come here. Come here. Okay, it's Bird, Brandon, Max.
The baseball field, it looks like any other baseball field, you know, chain link, background dugouts, everything else. They were dragging the field, the infield, when we got there. They were putting in the bases. It looked like any other day you might go to see a baseball game. The fences are a little bit different. The fences, some of them have, you know, razor wire on top of them. The warning track is actually part of a track that all the inmates use to walk around and to run around. So at any given time, if you're an outfielder going for a ball, you have to kind of watch out for people who are back there. There's also some tables where people sit and watch the game. So it's not like a usual ballpark in that sense.
All right, Mark, let's go throw strikes, babe.
The basketball court is down the third baseline.
Oh, that shot. That's a good shot.
And on two occasions, there was a line drive foul ball that went down there. And one guy was sitting there watching the basketball game. He just got hit on the fly in the head. And it was remarkable because he hardly flinched. And he didn't even turn around to say anything. He didn't say, like, what the heck? Kept watching the basketball game.
My name's David Steele. I am the manager of the team. I also am president of the Seattle NABA.
So what has the baseball been like since you've been here?
Well, they've been playing great baseball. We've been doing our best mediocre attempt to keep up with them. There's a couple hecklers here, and they actually seem to appreciate it when you heckle them back.
Hey, pitcher! Hey, pitcher, you better put some heat on that if you want to sign.
Some of it was very clever. He's been doing this, we were told he's been doing this for every team that visits. So he's very experienced. He gets to try out his material on different teams.
Hey, you better make it look good, because I overheard that.
And he was a partisan for the San Quentin team, definitely. So he was riding all of our players in a very, very loud and I found pretty funny ways. You know, he was a good heckler.
He's thinking. He's going backwards right now, man. He's going out backwards. Hey, don't make it that easy for me, buddy.
He says, all right, I got to leave you alone for a while. I got to go to the chiropractor. And he just kept going and going. I looked at him. I said, I thought you were going to the chiropractor. Because I'm just having too much fun. And finally, he left. But it was actually almost too quiet when he left.
Hey, no, that's not how you do it. Oh, boy. Hey, way
to go. These guys are really nice guys. And everybody understands that they...
Sorry, I hate to interrupt.
We're going to have Nicole bat. It's the first time a woman has ever batted here.
So Nicole came down. She's the girlfriend of one of the Seattle players, and she came down. And talking to her, her experience, she had a great experience. I was actually kind of concerned. You know, what is it like to put a woman suddenly in the midst of thousands of prisoners who probably haven't been around a woman in a long time, male prisoners? But she said she was treated with great respect. She didn't feel like anybody was harassing her in any way. She felt very comfortable right away.
I mean, you think you're coming into a maximum security prison, right? So you're going to around a bunch of criminals, right? Are they going to be intimidating? Are they going to be rude? Are they going to try to scare you? And they haven't at all. You can tell that they want us here.
So you had a very special time today. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I was asked to do the honorary first at-bat for our team, and come to find out, I'm the first female to actually have an at-bat here at the prison. And even though I got out, I almost made it to first base, and then I did actually break the bat, so first person to break the bat in the series as well. So I get a souvenir out of the deal.
People outside coming into prison think that we're all bad and we're all evil. And I try to convey to them that, look, we made mistakes. You know, we got caught, and right now we're serving our time for it. You know, and so to me personally, I hope that they take the word, the message out there that we're, you know, we're human beings also.
You know, I know the people who get to San Quentin, they're serious criminals. They've done things. They've been convicted of serious crimes. And I was just really astounded at how friendly, compassionate, interested people were. You know, I'm not letting anybody off the hook for crimes they committed, because I know there are victims behind all these crimes, you know, very serious crimes. But I was just astounded at how appreciative they were, how respectful they were of me and the team for coming down to be with them. And when I came out, I kind of felt it was like one of the most important days of my life. Sorry. It's hard to explain. You know, it was just baseball, but I think just being around so many people who had made terrible mistakes, and, you know, some of them, if they were out today, they may make the same mistakes, but it really talked to me about the potential all these people had and maybe still have, and what a waste it has been. Sorry. I just met people who had things gone better in their lives, would have different lives now. I talked to people who I really thought had kind of leadership potential and could have been out doing really productive things, but for bad choices or bad situations they got themselves into. And so I was really saddened by the loss of that potential for those lives. And I think that's what's really going to stick with me.
Steve Albertson is director of administration here at KNKX. Steve did much of the recording for that story, but we also had help from another person. Erlon Woods is an inmate at San Quentin and also the host of the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle about life on the inside. He did several of the interviews for us.
What's an example of a time when baseball has been important to you?
That's him talking with Brendan Riddle Terrell. Erlon has been in prison for 21 years on a 31-year sentence for attempted armed robbery. Well, now it's time for an update. Just before Thanksgiving, Erlon got word that Governor Jerry Brown of California had commuted Erlon's sentence and ordered that he be released from prison as soon as possible. Here's Erlon talking about it on his podcast with collaborator Nigel Poor.
Time to walk out that gate. They call you, they take you to the captain porch. Mm-hmm. They told me, they was like, Governor Brown feels you should be released. Just like that.
What was it like to hear that?
It's out of body. It's like, no. So when they're saying that, I'm thinking about my mama.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm thinking about my mama. She's up there. She's 70. She probably praised the Lord a million times, you know? I mean, it was like, and the associate warden that was in there, he was like, man, you know, this is the first time I'm witnessing one of these commutations. You know, he said, I feel happy for you.
Erlon Woods will be paroled to Oakland, where he plans to continue working on the podcast. We're so grateful to Erlon for his help on this story, and we congratulate him on his freedom. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is competition. So just in case you haven't spent a lot of time in the Seattle of the late 1800s, I can tell you it was a very different city.
Seattle was really established by conservative Midwesterners. They were Republicans, for heaven's sakes. But by the turn of the century, Seattle was really a wide-open town. I mean, it was rough and tumble. It had a disproportionate number of single guys. Now, think about our industries. They were on the water, and they were in the woods. And when the working season ended or the working day ended, all those guys poured into the city. And that led to a very licentious ethic in the community.
That's Leonard Garfield, executive director of Seattle's Museum of History and Industry. But Leonard says that already pressure was mounting on law enforcement to stop turning a blind eye. And into this mix stepped a guy who lived for sticking it to the competition. His name was John Considine.
He was raised in a conservative family in the Midwest. He was always reputed to be a very upstanding citizen, a very moral man. He was married, had a family, lived a very prim and proper life. In that sense, he fit in with the establishment of Seattle. But he had this incredible comfort level, if you will, with the seamier sides of life. He didn't mind running a little gambling business. He did not mind connecting women with men when that was called for. He was a guy who operated on the very edge of legality. And frankly, sometimes he operated illegally.
So he had sort of like a performing background himself, right? He was actually himself a performer. And then when he came to Seattle, he became kind of a magnate of this very particular type. Could you talk a little bit about his industry and what these box houses were?
Yeah, well, that's a very fascinating period of American entertainment history, where the intersection between legitimate entertainment and illegal activity, particularly prostitution, overlapped and very closely intersected. John Considine was in that business. The theaters he ran were entertainment halls. You could come and see legitimate entertainment, music and that sort of thing. But you also could take a private room, what they called boxes, and spend some time with a hostess or a barmaid. And what services were performed behind closed doors were really between the proprietor and the customer. They weren't really advertised. But it was well known that these were essentially legitimizing prostitution within the envelope of a theater. That's the kind of theater John Considine ran. He also had gambling, a lot of other activities that, generally speaking, were outside the law.
And he quickly rose to prominence. I mean, first of all, how did he get away with having this sort of ring of semi-legal or illegal entertainment?
Well, it all comes down to money. John Considine dealt in a cash economy. A lot of money came in from these guys who would patronize his businesses, and a lot of money went out, not just to the entertainers or to the women who worked in the box houses, but to the police. So basically, it was a system of payoffs where you bought the cooperation of the police, and they turned a blind eye to your more illicit activities.
So you have this kind of like almost a planned economy, right? And then an interloper came in before too long, and it was a name that a lot of people are going to recognize, right? Can you talk about this new upcoming rival to John Considine?
Well, you're talking about Wyatt Earp, I imagine, and Wyatt Earp already had a reputation across the West as being a guy who did a lot of dealings both legally and illegally. He had gone to Alaska along with many, many thousands of others to strike his fortune there and particularly to make some money off the prospectors. But Seattle was a place a lot of people went to after the gold rush because it was just a point of embarkation. It was a point of commerce. Wyatt Earp was one of those people who came to set up a business. His business was gambling. And that was a territory that John Considine was very active in as well. Well, as it happened, when Wyatt Earp came into Seattle, set up his business, within months of opening his doors, he was being raided. He was being harassed. He was literally being shut down by the police. And it's widely believed that John Considine, his competitor, was behind all that. Considine continued his gambling throughout that period, essentially unharassed by the police. Wyatt Earp was really forced to shut down and eventually leave town.
So he really did run Wyatt Earp out of Seattle.
He ran Wyatt Earp out of Seattle. And we don't think of Seattle as being the kind of gunslinging town of the Wild West. But in so many ways, in those first years of the 20th century, we were exactly that.
I'm so glad you mentioned gunslinging. So let's move into chapter two of John Considine's time here in Seattle, where it was characterized by another rivalry and in some ways much more serious one. Can you talk about his relationship with William Meredith?
Well, William Meredith was the chief of police. He was actually the acting chief of police, but he had the title and he had the badge and he had the guns. And he was actually an old friend of John Considine. Actually, he had worked for Considine in earlier years.
So Meredith running the police department here in Seattle, what was his like approach to the law?
Well, Meredith's approach to the job suddenly was to create a closed city, basically to focus on those who were breaking the law. The trouble was, is his focus was entirely on John Considine, his former friend and employer. Well, Considine did not like that, and he had all kinds of friends and connections in City Hall, and before you know it, Meredith was out of a job. He didn't go quietly, though. He spread a rumor that Considine was a crook, that he was having sexual affairs with a minor, that he got this young woman impregnated. So one day, when Meredith was sufficiently enraged, he loaded himself up with ammunition. He had a couple of guns with him, and he tracked down Considine to a drugstore in Pioneer Square.
And this is in broad daylight, right?
And this is in broad daylight. He sees this prominent business leader that he is having a feud with, and he basically pulls out his gun and tries to shoot him dead. He misses. He injures Considine, but does not inflict a fatal wound. But Considine, shocked, pulls out his own gun and shoots Meredith dead. Within minutes, he's arrested. He essentially turns himself in. The trial is held, and he's accused of murder in cold blood on a broad open day in downtown Seattle.
So Considine is on trial for murder, even though Meredith came bearing arms and bragging about her, or at least announcing that he intended to exact revenge on Considine.
Well, that's where it gets complicated, because there are people lining up on both sides. Different newspapers either favor the chief of police's story or they favor Considine. But at the end of the trial, it became clear that it was mostly Meredith who was the aggressor. As it turned out, the judicial system worked pretty efficiently. Considine was acquitted, and he went on to really sort of reinvent himself as a much more legitimate mainstream businessman.
What line of work did he go into then?
Well, he stayed in entertainment, but he really went into the vaudeville circuit. These great entertainment circuits that were the precursor to motion picture movie house circuits, many of them were established in Seattle, including one by John Considine called the Orpheum Circuit. It was one of the great vaudeville circuits where entertainers of all sorts and all stripes would pass through town, entertain thousands and thousands of people, and they really were the primary popular culture in America for decades. John Considine created one of those great circuits and became one of the most important entertainment impresarios in America.
So Considine now is in this third act where he's become this vaudeville impresario, really pioneer of the art form. But it seems like the guy cannot, you know, have a project without a nemesis. It seems like he thrives on competition in some way. So who became his nemesis then?
Well, Considine's competition were these two other great theater impresarios, John Court, and particularly Alexander Pantages. Pantages had an equally robust vaudeville circuit, also based in Seattle, and they were competing for the very same audiences and using the very same entertainers. And they weren't against tricking each other, stealing entertainment acts from each other, doing everything they could do, again, some legal, some less legal, to get audiences to come to their theaters. It was a great historic rivalry that continued for several decades. What's interesting, though, is that they were friendly rivals in one respect, which is that John Considine's son married Alexander Pantage's daughter, and that in turn created an entertainment dynasty that lasted for several decades.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the John Considine marrying Alexander Pantage's daughter, that son became an important producer for MGM. They in turn had children who became important actors in television and motion pictures. So several generations of Considines and Pantages continued in the entertainment industry, not as rivals, but as family members.
That's incredible. And I think one of the most striking things about this story, you know, not only is all the twists and turns that it takes, but like what an interesting guy who was known for private virtue, known for being a sober person, for being a family man. But then he also just had this cutthroat side where he just seemed like he was not willing to lay down for the competition.
Yeah, and I think that is an American theme. We're a nation that's built on entrepreneurship. We're built on a healthy sense of competition that everybody has a chance to grab for the gold ring. And Considine clearly did that. And despite all that competition and some of those setbacks, he almost always ended up on top. He was incredibly successful. He could look back at his life and say that he not only shaped Seattle's growth, but he really left an imprint on the entire nation's entertainment history.
For generations.
For generations.
Well, Leonard Garfield is Executive Director of the Museum of History and Industry here in Seattle. Thank you so much, Leonard.
Thank you.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and today the show is all about the highs and the lows of competition. Off of I-5, just north of Mount Vernon, you'll find some giants. They've been raised from the very beginning to crush the competition. I'm speaking, of course, about pumpkins. Squash, too, the really big ones. These staples of state fairs and autumn weigh-ins may seem quaint, but there is a ferocity behind the scenes among the men and women who devote themselves to raising these things. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing takes us into their world.
On a farm off of Highway 20, Joff Gould opens up the doors to a barn. Joff is 57 years old, with a little bit of gray at his temples. He's wearing glasses, and his boots are covered in mud. Sitting before us on pallets that somehow hold their weight are two enormous pumpkins and a squash.
We breed these things like you would bulls and horses. You're looking for the heaviest and best characteristics. And they also pooch and blob under their own weight because they're heavy. So
pooch and blob.
Yeah, this one's a good example here.
He points to a pumpkin that looks like a deflating beach ball. And by the way, when Joff says any numbers, he is talking pounds.
This is my 748, and as you can see, it pooched and blobbed, and it didn't get very tall, but it got wide. They come in all shapes and sizes. They really do. They might look like faces. We were at a way off last Saturday in Seattle and saw some of the strangest and ugliest things you ever want to see.
When we meet, it's October, and this is the time of year when the weigh-offs happen. The contest to see who has the biggest specimen. This is World Series time.
We start the seeds just a little bit after the baseball season, and then we go through the whole summer grind like baseball, and then baseball's now finishing up into the playoffs, and here we are at the weigh-offs. So it's a long year. It's a grind. If you want to do it well, you pretty much have no life during that time frame, and you just get used to that. You see people getting to do stuff, but you know you can't. You got to be at the patch, but just depends how bad you want it. And when you see the big ones, you want it bad. You want it bad.
When you say if you really want to do this and be good at it, you have to have no life, what does that involve in the summer?
I commute 3 times a week. I live in my car, which is always a mess. I got clothes in my trunk. It's just full of socks and rain gear and hats and tools. And you spin out of control for those 6 months.
During the growing season, Joff drives to the Skagit Valley 3 times a week from his home in Kent. These giants, they need to be fed and watered. Their vines need to be protected. They are nutrient-hungry balls and chains that would be a burden to just about anyone else. But not to Joff. He loves all of the time that this requires him to spend outside. It's quiet out here, and he never gets tired of watching these fruits expand.
They grow 30 to 50 pounds a day. You can come back in 2 days and see it's grown again enormously. It's fun. It's addictive. It's a good competitive outlet. I'm past the point where injuries prevent me from playing recreational sport, and this is something that's usually you're not going to get injured at, and you can be competitive and try and beat your best and beat everybody.
We head out into Joff's 3-acre patch that he rents just for growing pumpkins and squash, and where some really big ones are still putting on the pounds. There are islands of vines, tangles of green that surround large fruits here and there. We check out a big pumpkin growing in its own house, its very own little house that Joff built from scratch out of tubing and black plastic.
With the black plastic, it raises the temperature 10 degrees from the surrounding area. So you can probably feel it's warmer in here than it was outside, right?
It is, yeah. Just ever so slightly, but it's noticeable. Yes. Oh, and it has a blanket on.
It has a blanket. We get to a certain stage of the season, we put the blankets on them to keep them warm underneath. Usually I'll find a deal in midsummer on a nice fleece blanket that's on sale, and I'll get like three or four of them that are big enough to go on pumpkins. So.
And again, what's the reasoning for keeping them warm?
They grow better if it's warm as opposed to cold, so you want to keep those inches going. It thumps hard.
What do you mean it thumps hard?
When you knock on it, you want to hear that hard sound when you knock on it. And you also like this cantaloping, because that usually means heavy as well.
Why does it, when you hear the knock hard, why does that?
That means the walls are solid in there. The weight of these giants is determined by the thickness of the walls. Now we're going to see the squash.
So that is a pumpkin.
That's a pumpkin there.
And this is a squash.
This is a squash. Squash have to be green or gray. This one's green. It's not, doesn't have quite the color my squash in the barn did, but it's still green, still a squash. Size is what we're looking for here.
And size is exactly what is sitting warm and cozy under another fleece blanket. This squash is probably as big as the hood of your car.
It's big.
It's huge.
It's huge.
It is huge. Wow.
Yeah, it's going to be the heaviest thing I've ever grown, and I think I got a good shot at getting a state record this Saturday. Nobody's going to be expecting us to roll into Central Market with this thing.
When I meet Joff a few days later at the weigh-off outside of a grocery store in Shoreline, his greenish-gray blob of a squash is on the scale, placed there by a small crane.
My squash is on the scale right now. It just set a Washington state record at 1,216.5 pounds. This record that I broke today was set back in 2004.
For the top prize, he got $850. And not only did Joff's squash set a new state record, it is officially the sixth largest in the world for this season. After the contest, the squash spent its remaining days on display outside of the grocery store. And then on November 1st, the day just after Halloween, the squash's stationary victory lap came to an end. Joff reduced his record breaker with a machete and harvested more than 300 seeds. This is how this successful genetic line will continue into the future. Joff left the empty shell in front of the store, and then the next day the remains were reduced further, this time with the help of a chainsaw. And those pieces were hauled off to a pasture and fed to a herd of cows.
Sound effects, Jennifer Wing. Sound Effect is produced by Jennifer, along with Kevin Kniestead and Posey Gruner. Special thanks this week to Steve Albertson, Bill Drummond, and Erlon Woods. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We're back next week when our theme is My Other Family. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.